listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library. Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. We're your hosts. I'm Abby.
I'm also Abby. We're librarians at the Central Library.
In this episode, we're sharing audio from a recent JMRL virtual program about seasonal affective disorder.
But before we get to that, we're going to check in on our reading resolutions, and of course, we've got book chat.
Okay, let's check in on our reading resolutions. We're 2 weeks into the new year, which we know is when people sometimes start to fall off or rethink their resolutions, so we want to make sure that we stick with a few of our reading goals this year.
Definitely. And as a reminder, we are hosting an accountability club to help you stick with your resolutions, whether they be reading related or not. So do please check jmrl.org or the link in our show notes for instructions on how to join our monthly meetings and our online web space that we're having 24/7.
That is an excellent point. And so far, talking resolutions, have you had any luck with your reading goals so far?
I have. So to remind you all, one of my goals was to read every day. And so far, at the time of this recording, I have read every day, which I'm proud of. I was also hoping to read Coretta Scott King award-winning books, which I have done. And my last goal was to read a book from every decade starting in 1910. That is the one that I have not yet really made any progress on. So it may or may not get tweaked, but two out of my three reading resolutions, I'm feeling pretty good about. How about you, Abby?
That's excellent. So far, my favorite reading resolution, which is to read more books with a main or supporting character named Abby. I haven't had any luck with that one yet, but I did just have one suggested to me, so I've got that on my list, and I, of course, don't have the title of that book in front of me, so when I do finally get it, I will let you all know. My other resolutions, one was to put down books that I wasn't clicking with or didn't have, you know, like the mental space for at the time, and I will say I have successfully put down and returned one book so far. It was a good book. I hope to read it at another point, but it was a little bit too heavy for the past couple of weeks that we've had. So I returned it and I made a note to maybe pick it back up when there are fewer, you know, very heavy news stories on my mind. My other reading resolution was to read more nonfiction. And the book that I put down was nonfiction. So I'm just going to count that as a win for both because I picked up a nonfiction book. And even if I didn't finish it, the intention was there. So other than that, I have mostly been reading fiction, but they're books that I'm enjoying. And so I think that's what's important right now is I'm really kind of focusing on that, put down books I'm not feeling and focus on the ones I'm enjoying. So far so good, I would say.
Awesome. And if we want to jump into book chat, I actually have the book that I would like to chat about. This podcast has to do with reading, so it's perfect for our reading resolutions. And it's called The Enchanted Hour. It's by Megan Cox Gurdon. She is the Wall Street Journal's children's book reviewer. She has been since 2005. And this book is all about the magic and power of reading out loud. So it's a different kind of reading. We had talked about reading to children, and a large chunk of this book is devoted to that practice and the science behind reading out loud to young people. But what I loved about it is that it's really applicable to anyone. So the book is really well done. I feel like a lot of books operate kind of on this premise of a promise, like if you follow this specific prescription, quote unquote, of what to do, it's going to change your life and you'll be so much better for it. It's almost a little bit too regimented. So this book is not like that. It does have a reading list supplied, and the last quarter of it does kind of address some of those how-to strategies, But the whole first three quarters of the book is really best described as just kind of some delightful information. So it's facts and figures. There's neuroscience and behavioral and social science studies, scholarly stuff, and journalism, history, culture. It's a really cool mashup, as well as some of her personal stories. So there's a little bit of memoir in there as well. But then you, as the reader, can kind of take all of that, and you just get to figure out how reading out loud fits into your own life. So my enchanted hour of reading out loud might look very different from yours, but that's why I appreciated the book. It really gives you room to take all of her information and ideas and then make it your own. So it's also a really readable book. It's engaging, super inspiring, not dense or heavy. It wasn't boring in its presentation. So the one interesting thing that I found, actually, though, when I was looking at some other just critiques or ideas of this book, is some critics say that Gurdon kind of contradicts herself, or she refuses to be definitive as she discusses like the problematic classics, especially when she's talking about children's books, because, you know, there's a whole section where she's talking about, you know, quote, classic literature, right, and the problems, whatever. But I personally found her treatment of the topic to be pretty fair and understandable, because it is a tough topic. You can't be too black and white definitive when you're trying to talk about every single book. And I did appreciate that she wholeheartedly and unequivocally condemns censorship of all kinds, which I think is very important. And it reminded me of the ALA's statement on the freedom to read. Mm-hmm. They say, freedom itself is a dangerous way of life, but it is ours. And I think that's very fun. So that's kind of the one interesting thing that I found, or not necessarily interesting, but some critics had to say, you know, we don't know how she's treating the classics, but it's a good read. It's all about reading out loud, and I would recommend it for people who are interested too, even if your resolution is something about technology. Mm-hmm. If you want to minimize your technology use or just kind of be more present in the present moment, there are so many benefits of reading out loud.
That's excellent. I don't have a small child, but we work with adults mostly. We are not in the children's department, so I do not have a lot of experience with reading out loud. But that makes me more intrigued. I think I will have to pick up this book at some point.
You might, because it also would fall into your resolution of reading nonfiction, because, I don't remember its exact call number, but I'm sure it's a nonfiction book. It's
right. Yeah, fiction. It sounds like it.
So, yeah. See, excellent. It would work for you.
Perfect. It'll check so many boxes. that's great. I like that description of it as a mashup of so many things. And I think it takes a skilled writer to take all of those different kinds of things and make them accessible to a reader. So I love that somebody who's writing about reading is doing it in a way that it's readable. that's lovely.
It's very genre bending. It's genre mm-hmm. bending. That's too why I was like, is it nonfiction? I mean, it certainly is, but it's so many things mm-hmm. and it feels very readable. So you feel like you're just kind of lost in this world of reading. Very fun.
Nice. Very good. I did not read a nonfiction book of any sort. As you might have guessed based on my resolution report. But what I read was a book called The Scapegracers by Hannah Abigail Clark. So this is the first book in what's planned to be a young adult series. And I picked it up after I just read like the publisher summary, which was an outcast teenage lesbian witch finds her coven hidden amongst the popular girls in her school and performs some seriously awesome magic in the process. That was enough to intrigue me, so I picked it up. And in this book, we follow Sideways Pike. She's our queer teenage witch. She gets, you know, she's just been invited to a Halloween party hosted by the three most popular and intimidating girls in her school. Their popularity is almost like a sense of fear that they instill in their peers. Like they are like a terrifying popular trio at the top of the social hierarchy. So this town that they live in has a Halloween party tradition. Throughout the month of October, the teens throwing parties try to build the wow and scare factors each weekend. And so these three popular girls, Jing, Yates, and Daisy, this tightly knit group of three, they're determined to make this year the best year, outdo everyone who's ever hosted parties before them. So they bring in Sideways, our narrator, to do magic. They invite her to the party to cast a spell, like using them as part of her circle, right? To do magic, to just do something that can't be topped at a party. Because otherwise this is set in, like, you know, kind of a contemporary world where magic is like something some people believe in, but not really like it's not like a set part of the world, you know what I mean? The magic that she cast that night is beyond their expectations. It's beyond her own. She's not really even sure how she did it. She cast spells she didn't know she was capable of. And so the four of them start spending time together. They do a little more magic together and begin to form a bond. And as they're forming this bond, there are a few like kind of mysterious characters who show up, and they really complicate things in dramatic ways. There's like a little bit of adventure mixed in, but just like this coming, it's almost coming of age, but like coming into your magic, right, is kind of the focus of the story. So this was a fun read for me. I don't know that fun is the right word. You've got magic and you've got this like very sinister dramatic element, and then like standard teen relationships all kind of thrown into one. So it's great for readers of young adult books who like magic or fantasy with like a very kind of dark edge. That's what I would say. I enjoyed it. It didn't read like anything else I've read that's got young adult witches, maybe some similar themes, but it was like a new take.
Sinister element that you mentioned, is that mostly character driven, like those mysterious people that come in, or is it similar to some of your other favorite books where it's elemental or nature driven?
Much more character driven. Yeah. Yes. This is not like, there's not like impending societal collapse in this one. Unusual for my picks, but yeah.
shady kind of bad guy figures, right? Almost. Okay, and cool.
Doing some things that really put some of our other characters in danger. So there's like this very real sense of danger, but it's good. It's a fun escape if you want something that is very unlike, you know, the news that we see today. There are no pandemics or anything, which is a good change for me too. I picked up a few too many of those last year, so.
It is set kind of in our contemporary world. Like, did you see any references that almost made it feel like today's world, but with these wacky characters?
Yeah, so like they're texting each other. They've got smartphones, that sort of thing. They're on like equivalents to our social media. So it's definitely set today, just with real magic.
Next, we'll hear a recording of an event that took place earlier this month about seasonal affective disorder. This presentation offered an overview of seasonal affective disorder, its biological underpinnings, and some potential treatment options. It was led by Callie Caldwell, who is a registered nurse, and she will graduate in May as a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner.
Hey everyone, it's really awesome to see people who don't have masks on their faces. It's very exciting to see you guys smile and see your facial expression. So as Abby pointed out, I am currently a bedside nurse. I predominantly work right now in the ICU, taking care of COVID patients. And after I graduate, I will be an outpatient private practice psychiatric provider. and begin working on my DNP, which is a doctorate level nursing degree. today we're going to talk about seasonal affective disorder. I'm going to go ahead and get right into it. If you have any questions, please interrupt me. I'd like this to be as interactive as it can be. It's kind of hard when we're not all together, but I find that things are more fun and knowledge sticks a lot better that way. Okay, so when we talk about seasonal affective disorder, the first thing that I'd like to do is kind of go back to basics and talk about what these words mean. So when we're talking about this, seasonal really means that it's inconsistent. It has a really large role within the part of the year that you're in. When we talk about affect here in psychiatry, we're talking about an observable state. So someone's observable mental or emotional state. And when we talk about disorder, it's just a lack of regular, like a deviation from normal. Okay. Let's see. And let me move my notes out of your way. So the secret about SAD is that it is not a real diagnosis. And what I mean by that is that it is not in the DSM. So it's not in the diagnostic and statistic manual for diagnosing mental health or psychiatric disorders. What it is a mood disorder that has a seasonal pattern, and the mood disorder type is depression. And we really see it most impacting patients in January and February. So we're right in the midst of when we would start seeing this pattern be exhibited in these patients. And in order to talk about the basic concept of depression within this disorder, we first need to talk about depression, right? And this is per DSM-5 criteria. So the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, which I'll talk about here in just a second so that we all know what that looks like, gives us criteria for diagnosing people with a specific disorder. And in order to meet the criteria for major depressive disorder, which is the basis, the basic mood disorder of SAD, you have to have 5 of the items that you see on your screen, and at least one of them has to be the underlined ones. So for 2 weeks, almost every day, you have either feelings of sadness, hopelessness, or feeling like emotionally empty, or a significant loss of interest in something you used to enjoy doing. So this cannot be someone who always is very negative, like consistently, that's a personality trait. And it cannot be someone who has never liked gardening and now we notice that they don't like gardening, right? This has to be a deviation from their previous behavior. So in addition to one, at least one of those two traits, you have to have a significant change in appetite. And it can go up or down, but within 1 month, it has to be significant enough that it would change your weight by 5%. Insomnia and hypersomnia, just talk about sleep quantity. So when you're showing insomnia, you're sleeping less, and hypersomnia, sleeping more. And this isn't per a baseline that is set by an American association. This is per your baseline or per the patient's baseline, because every person is different. So if I normally sleep 6 hours a night, and I've been doing that for several years, and then all of a sudden I'm requiring 8 or 9 hours of sleep a night, that's a big change for me, whereas that may be normal for other people. So the next one is being noticeably restless and or lethargic. So lethargic is just someone who their musculoskeletal behavior is slowed, it's diminished. They may be drowsy, and you can actually physically see that in their appearance, that everything that they do feels very slow. And again, that's according to the patient's baseline or your baseline, not the people around them. So feeling fatigued is a pretty common one. Feeling guilty or worthless. This is a feeling that doesn't actually have a emotional trigger. So an example would be if you feel guilty because you went gambling and you lost a significant quantity of money that your family needed, that might be a trigger that would lead the average individual to feel guilty. This patient or this person would not have a trigger to feel guilty. It would just be an emotional state for them. The next one is the inability to focus, and also that can come with the lack of ability to make decisions. And then the final one, which most of us have heard of, may be thoughts of death or suicide. So it's not necessarily a thinking of, I want to hurt myself, I have a plan to hurt myself, I think I'm going to commit suicide. It can be strictly the thought of passing away, or thinking that maybe it would be better if I weren't here anymore. Before we move on to how this relates to SAD, does anyone have any questions? No. Okay. Let's see. Oh, before I move on, I did want to talk briefly, just because I want to make sure I'm covering like the biological basis that you guys are interested in, and some things that we rule out when we're looking for these signs and symptoms. So in patients that have symptoms that look like this, so again, five or more, and at least every day for 2 weeks, almost every day for 2 weeks, and it has to include at least one of the underlined, I want to rule out hypothyroidism, because hypothyroidism can really cause a slowing and a general fatigue within patients. Blood sugar issues, okay? A viral infection, specifically mono, can cause patients to become very, very lethargic, very tired very quickly. And then this should not be related to a pattern of substance abuse or grief or loss. So if you're seeing this type of behavior pattern, but it's around alcohol consumption, or it is around specifically the loss or passing of someone or something in your life, this probably will not come back to MDD on its own. It's probably related to the substance or the loss, okay? So what is the difference between regular depression, which we just talked about, and SAD? For SAD criteria, you have to have depression symptoms, the ones we just talked about, but they are going to only occur in the wintertime and they are going to resolve in the summer. Specifically, as the days get longer, you'll see resolution. As the days get longer, you'll start to see resolution of the behavior and or feelings and mood disturbance. And you will see it start to come on either early fall or late fall, like November, December timeframe. A lot. So like I said, this is not a DSM-5, and I'll talk about what that is in a minute. This is not a DSM-5 criteria. So a psychiatrist would not diagnose seasonal affective disorder. They would diagnose depression with a seasonal pattern or something that sounds very similar to that. However, most people do want symptoms to occur each year for at least two consecutive years in order to diagnose this. Some other things it's important to note are that the symptoms can last 5 months out of the year, unfortunately. Onset is usually in adulthood, averages between like 18 and 35. It's fairly common in American adults. It's like 5% of the population or more. And women are affected twice as much. They make up about 70% of the population diagnosed with something like SAD or a similar concept. And there is a geographical indicator. So the further you move away from the equator does increase your potential. and so someone who lives in Florida, for example, would have significantly less potential for this compared to us, because we live in Virginia or wherever you guys may be. Now, I keep talking about the DSM-5, so I just want to make sure we know what that is before I move on. And the DSM-5 is a book, and there's an electronic version. And basically, it is created, this is the fifth edition that we're on, which is why the five is on the end. It is created to form a diagnosis around a set of symptoms. And the reason we need that is because it helps us to form treatment options and algorithms. The other thing we use it for is insurance companies use it for billing purposes. Hospitals use it in order to research data. Like for example, if I fall within a depressive subtype and someone else falls within an anxious subtype, we would not be in the same group depending on the data needed, okay? Let me see. Sorry, I have some notes in front of me. All right. This is a gray area that I'm talking about here. This is from the National Institute of Mental Health. It is not in any of the textbooks that I utilized to create this, but I did think it was very insightful and helpful to know about. So I am going to talk about it. And what the NIH says is that there are different types. So the rare type is the individuals that you see symptomology in the summer. And so when we looked at those criteria, I'll go back just for a second. When we looked at these criteria to meet depression criteria, these people would suffer one of these in the summer. And then when you see this hypersomnia or insomnia, they would feel less inclined to sleep. They would feel more restless and anxious. They would be a little more frantic when it comes to making decisions. Okay. And that would be the summer pattern patients, which are a lot less frequently seen. Then you have the winter pattern patients. So these are your traditional patients when you think of this winter blues type of diagnosis. So these are going to be your patients that sleep a lot more. Weight gain, specifically, the NIH attributes it to craving carbohydrates. And there is a correlation between, I shouldn't say the word correlation, but there is some research that suggests that carbohydrate intake does have an impact in the brain on serotonin. And I'll talk about serotonin in just a second. So keep that in mind when I go to that slide. So weight gain and social isolation. These are going to be the people who kind of don't reach out as much. They may kind of be a little more distant this time of year in the winter time. And then in the summer, they become a little bit more socially engaging. So why do we think that this happens? We don't know. That is the straightforward, honest answer about almost everything within psychiatry these days. And before I move forward, I just want to kind of talk really quickly about psychiatry versus psychology. So psychology is the study of the brain and how the brain works. And therapeutic, non-medicinal, non-pharmacological interventions. Whereas psychiatry is a specialty that takes into account the pharmacological interventions, okay? So when we talk about within psychiatry and psychology, why we think this happens, the first one is a serotonin-based concept. And it is that the serotonin in the brain acts as an antidepressant, and that's simplifying it. It's very oversimplified, but there are books and books and books that talk about the impact of serotonin. So we're not going to dig too deep into that. But serotonin is the neurotransmitter that most antidepressants work on, and they're usually working to increase the quantity of serotonin in the brain. So when we know that that's how antidepressants work, we can see how if less light means less serotonin production or less available serotonin, that could lead to depression. The second one, which most of us have heard of, is called melatonin. So melatonin is something produced in the brain naturally at nighttime for most of us. As the light, the external light source decreases, our body will start producing melatonin in order to prepare us for sleep. And so some experts are recommending, or I should say suggesting, that in the wintertime, these patients are overproducing melatonin, which is causing some of the sedation impact and causing kind of a slowed, low-key pathophysiological process. So sedation just meaning lethargy, less likely to go out and do this and do that and play sports and everything else, right? And let me move this a little bit. And then I'm going to talk about vitamin D just for a second. And I put it in separate marks just because the two primary concepts are serotonin and melatonin when we talk about what we think is going on with this process. But vitamin D is what we call serotonergic, which means similar to antidepressants, it helps to boost the serotonin in the brain. And so the thought process behind this is in the summertime, there's a lot of sunlight. And when the sunlight touches our skin, it helps our kidneys activate a good part of vitamin D that we can use in our body. And in the wintertime, when there's less sunlight available, our bodies have a harder time converting non-active vitamin D to active vitamin D in our kidneys. All right, so with what we just talked about, let's talk about our treatment options. As someone with a nursing background, I advocate to utilize non-pharmacological interventions if it can potentiate healing to the level that we want. So I don't recommend going out and getting a pill as your first choice, right? But for this disease process, that is a possibility. And so what we would use would be an antidepressant. So you've heard of SSRIs and SNRIs, and those are traditional things like Zoloft, things that you've heard of. And when you are talking about that with your provider, generally what we are going to use to make a recommendation on a medicine is going to be the side effect profile. Some really common side effects of taking an antidepressant are going to include mania, increased appetite, anxiety for some patients, sexual dysfunction is not uncommon. And so it's a big decision to choose to take a medication, and it definitely needs to be discussed with whoever's overseeing your treatment. In addition to that, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is usually called CBT, is the best kind of therapy for this disease. It's also called talk therapy. And the goal of CBT when you're meeting with your provider is to, first of all, help you improve your internal dialogue. So helps you find out, are you saying negative things to yourself or about your circumstances? And maybe you don't realize it, which can contribute to depression. The second thing it helps to do is increase the resources and coping mechanisms that you have on your own without an external resource, so that when you do start to feel down, overwhelmed, sad, you have something to look at and go to for support, regardless of what's going on around you. That is not specific to SAD. That is just basic depression treatment, right? However, if we come over here and look at phototherapy, that's what a lot of people recommend, especially holistic providers, for people who are having depressive symptoms in the wintertime. So I just wanted to clarify a couple of points about phototherapy. And phototherapy is kind of exactly what it sounds like. You get a big light and you sit it on a desk. And you can buy them online for anywhere from, I think, $50 to $250, depending on what you're looking for. And it just promotes the sensory impact that sunlight has in the summer hours. in order to promote a more natural like circadian rhythm or day-night rhythm. So there are a couple of things to know. The first thing is usually we recommend it before sunrise or after sunset. So what we're trying to do is as the daylight hours start to slim down in the wintertime, we're artificially, you know, telling our body that that's not the case, that instead of 6 hours of daylight today, I actually have 7 hours, but one of those hours was artificially manufactured by a light source. We've been using it since the 1980s, really for sleep disorders. You do not want to put it directly in front of you. So you want it to be off to the side. Generally, when you're talking about the most, I can't think of the word that I want to use, but the strongest evidence source, it's 10,000 lux or better. Definitely ultraviolet free. This is not a light source that you are going to get a tan. Okay, it's not going to have any of that kind of impact. If it does, you are really increasing your risk for skin cancer. So you want to, if you choose to go out and purchase one of these items, you want to make sure that it is UV free. And then the recommendation for how long to use it is going to be dependent upon the strength that you purchase, your manufacturer guidelines. So for example, if I purchase a 5,000 lux light source, I might need a little bit longer than if I purchase a 10,000 lux light source. And the second thing you need to take into account is your provider recommendation when you're looking at something like this. I'm also just briefly going to talk about two things, just because I have a note down here to mention them. One is omega-3 fatty acids. So EPA, DHA, that's like your flaxseed oil and fish oil and rosehip oil and stuff like that. It does show positive correlation when it comes to, let me say this right, because research and evidence is, it's important to verbalize it correctly. So it does show that in locations where people eat more fish, they have less depressive symptoms. The second thing is vitamin D3. So there's vitamin D. You can buy as a pill, but there are two types. There's vitamin D2 and there's vitamin D3. Vitamin D2 is a plant-based, like a vegan alternative. Vitamin D3 comes from animal sources, but vitamin D3 is significantly better metabolized by the body. And so when we're talking about the serotonergic, remember the antidepressant boosting impact that it has in the brain, the one that's going to be a lot better, if that's what you're using it for, is going to be the vitamin D3. So these are some things that I used for today. The primary thing we talked about was the DSM-5, just because that is really the driving force behind a provider giving anyone a diagnosis as far as mental health goes. And then the other thing on here is, I just wanted to mention it, is that suicide is a very real risk for a large portion of Americans. The latest statistics in America show that about 130 people die every day of suicide. Males are a lot more prone than females. Females generally have more attempts, but males have more success with suicide attempts. So if anyone is ever feeling sad, or if you have friends that ever feel sad or down, this is a great number to store in your phone so that if you ever need to, you can call and get help instead of making a rash decision that you can't take back. Okay, sorry to end on kind of a sad note. I will open this up to questions or anything else Abby feels is helpful. Let me exit.
I had a question, Callie. And also feel free for all of our participants. You can, I wrote in the chat that you can wave your hand or you can pop your questions in the chat, but you can also unmute yourself. I was just offering to unmute you for those who don't know how to unmute, but if you do, feel free to unmute yourself. But I do have a question just to kick us off, get us started. If you go to your biological underpinnings slide. I think you mentioned serotonin, melatonin, and yeah, vitamin D. So I thought that was really interesting, especially the melatonin part about how they think some people might be overproducing melatonin, or the serotonin was less serotonin with less sunlight. Can you explain that connection between the sunlight and serotonin? Is it just that if I go out into the sunlight, my body makes more of it? And also, I guess a follow-up question after you explain that would be, if those three are kind of three of the biological underpinnings, I guess there's no way for your doctor to kind of check those things, right? Like, would you be able to go to the doctor and they determine for you that, oh, you're making too much melatonin? Or is that possible?
I mean, that is a really cool question. So, and it really is, like you're saying, not something we have a lot of actual evidence base about, because it's really hard to test the levels of these items, and it's really hard to see their impact in the brain. So the way the brain works is there are cells with space between them. And the way that the brain sends signals is cells send, I think of them in my mind almost as like floating boats, but it is a neurotransmitter, of which serotonin is one, norepinephrine is one, GABA is one. So if there's several of them, and each cell sends one to the next cell. And that's how we have seizures. That is how our thought processes like pass through. It is really, really cool. But what makes it so challenging to study is the fact that we really can't take a piece of your brain out and test the levels within the brain the way I could take some of your blood and test how much calcium is in your blood. There are several imaging studies that we're currently looking at to try to figure out, are there different levels of activation in different parts of the brain that utilize more of a specific neurotransmitter than others? So an example could be dopamine. So in ADHD, people who have hyperactivity and inattention on a clinical level, we have noticed that there's different levels of dopamine in their prefrontal cortex, which drives behavior. And so we're able to kind of figure some of that out by stimulating the brain while we do imaging, but there really isn't any specific way to differentiate which one is the cause over the other, which is kind of one of the things I love about psychiatry, is a lot of it is just a gray mishmash of questions. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that does explain about the melatonin and just being able to test for that. So how about the serotonin with the sunlight connection? Is it, how do those two go together?
So we're still not, so much of this is gray. We're still not 100% sure. What we do know is that things that boost your serotonin are things that generally make, so things that you love. Like, Abby, I have a feeling you love books. And so for you, when you walk in and you're surrounded by books and there's all these great worlds and opportunities to experience these books around you, for you, that personally causes your brain to release serotonin. For someone who is like a mechanic and they walk into the shop, and for them, like being around cars and smelling engines and, you know, things like that, that is something that for them may promote the release of serotonin. And so it's different for each person. Really, things that we know for everyone release it is just happy experiences, building happy memories. Anytime you're stimulating a part of your brain that feels pleasant. And so that's part of the problem as well with drugs that creates an addiction behavior or an addiction pattern. So the clear answer is we're not 100% sure. But the like helpful answer is that almost anything that makes you feel good, if it's going to the gym and doing yoga, or if it's talking to your best friend on the phone, or if it's petting your dog, that makes you feel good. It's promoting the release of serotonin in your brain. And some other things come into play. So dopamine and norepinephrine are two other big ones. I'm not going to go too far into that rabbit hole because they're not quite as relevant to depression from this perspective. Does that kind of answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, I think it does, especially because, yeah, the sunlight thing. Okay, I'm going to, because sunlight is pleasurable and it's nice. And so I see the connection there.
And there's also the vitamin D. Like, let's remember the vitamin D right here. So vitamin D is in the kidneys, is converted to a usable, it's called OH, but the short-term impact, or the short story impact, is just that vitamin D in its active form allows your body to transmit serotonin signals in the brain. This is a non-medical recommendation, but I do like to always put it at the end of anything that talks about mental health. The first thing is reach out to a provider that you trust. The second thing is let your loved ones know that you're struggling. It's great if you have someone who can just check on you once a week or twice a week and just see how you're doing. And the third thing, which I've already talked about, is a patient of mine actually said it, and I'm stealing it from him, but he said I could. Pills don't teach skills. And so the first line is not always going to be a tablet. It may be, you know, we need to start therapy and start trying to maintain a really normal routine, especially in seasonal affective disorder, and especially in depression. We can really get caught in a hole where we are not waking up at a similar time every day. We're not maintaining a very good routine. And especially in our current environment with the coronavirus pandemic, a lot of people have found that it's creating depression just by eliminating a lot of their basic lifestyle. And they're adapting in ways that maybe aren't super positive. So things that we can do even before an appointment with a provider would include trying to start waking up at the same time every day. If you have pets or you eat breakfast, trying to get a same time frame to do that, just trying to create a structure within life so that as things change in our environment, we still have like a pattern of behavior that keeps us consistent. And it has two benefits. So the first one is when you have a pattern of behavior that's pretty solidified, it's easy to recognize when something's falling, right? It's easy to recognize when you're not feeling right and things are changing and you don't know what to do. And the second thing is it's good for humans. You know, a long, long time ago, I'm not going to get on a soapbox, but a long, long time ago, we had to go hunt for our food and we had to kind of be a lot more physically active and a lot more engaged with society than we are now. So it's really important to promote that kind of engagement and that kind of pattern. And I think that's all that I wanted to say about that. But the first thing is definitely starting to take care of yourself, finding a provider that you trust, and telling people that love you that you are struggling.
A big thank you to Callie Caldwell. Thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise with us. She had some really important information about this very common phenomenon. So we hope that you were able to learn something new and that you'll share this information with friends or family who may benefit.
Absolutely. At the time of this recording, JMRL is currently offering contactless curbside pickup for books at all branches Monday through Saturday, as well as Sunday at the Central Library. We currently do not have any in-building services available, but our curbside hours do vary by branch, so we will link to further information about those hours and procedures for curbside in our show notes. Please note that it still might take longer than normal for your items to be ready to pick up, so we appreciate your patience while we continue to prioritize the safety and well-being of patrons and staff.
Podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org. Please hit subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to this podcast. If you have books that you'd like us to read and discuss or topics that you'd like to hear on a future episode, please email us at podcast@jmrl.org.
That's all for us today. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more content. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page.